Hi, I'm Andrew. Welcome to the Review of Two Does Geo Engineering podcast. I'm here today with Morrissey, sadly not the real Morrissey, who'd be much more expensive than we could afford, but William Morrissey. And we're going to be talking about whether solar radiation management geoengineering is likely to lead to interstate conflict. In short, whether we're all going to go to war and die for the sake of SRM. And this cheery topic on a dull, grey British morning, I'm here to have a long chat about the details of a very controversial subject, which has been vexing people for quite some time. So, in summary, before we get into the main meat of it, is geoengineering going to kill us all?
Oh, is that a question to me?
Yes.
No.
That's why we've got you on.
I'm not arguing that geoengineering is going to kill us all. I'm arguing that people are going to kill themselves, potentially over geoengineering. But essentially, the practice represents a potential escalatory threat that, if we allow it to operate independently based on the whims of individual states, it's probably going to be the sort of thing that aggravates interstate tensions and leads to conflict.
Okay. I mean, that's a traditional sort of geoengineering doomer scenario. Well, I'm quite familiar with the idea that we're all going to have a massive bun fight about geoengineering. But how realistic is that? Because states have to resolve all kinds of tension. And what I've found, and we've spoken about this very issue on a lot of people who've come on the podcast in the past and had conversations based on typically game theoretic papers where they have these kind of highly idealized state interactions where people will only have geoengineering policies to decide and they don't have any other complicating factors like, for example, international trade or family ties or cultural links or anything like that. And, you know, people just publish papers that basically say, you know, I've solved my equations, and they predict that everyone goes to war. And it just, I read papers like that and I just think that is just not how international relations work. It's much more subtle and complicated. So what, before we go into the details of what your paper addresses, do you recognize the inherent issues with the literature that exist at the moment, in that the papers that have come out on the subject typically are underestimating the complexity when they do any kind of numerical modeling? I mean, obviously the complexity is enormous, so you couldn't ever model the full complexity, but they underestimate the complexity so grossly that their whole approach to the problem, to my mind, seems to be bordering on meaningless. I mean, do you think that's a fair criticism of the background literature on this topic, or do you think I'm being too negative?
I don't know if you're being too negative. I think one of the things that my paper tries to address is that there is no contextualization, especially of the idealized modeling of geoengineering outcomes. So I think that you're exactly right, that any paper that doesn't situate a future geoengineering scenario inside a complex international relations environment is going to be deficient in examining sort of the implications of the interactions. This paper has no modeling. This paper has no equations. I'm not a climatologist. I'm a security. My background's in security, and I'm not.
What type of security?
International relations, you know, primarily.
Academic, not commercial. You're not like a cybersecurity expert or a bodyguard or anything like that.
You study
security issues.
Yes, academically and professionally. And one of the things in coming across geoengineering, one of the things that I immediately recognized was that there was no contextualization. So if a state acted in the way that was laid out in some of these models, my read of the literature was essentially that, like, that's going to cause a fight. Like, people are going to go to war over this if a state did sort of the traditional, like, unilateral actor deployment of SAI, where a state just goes and does it. And the literature treats this as a sort of universal positive that everyone would just accept. And in fact, I came across in a couple of different pieces the direct authors directly stating that just the international community would flat out just accept the deployment. And I find that incredibly difficult to believe for a number of reasons that which I lay on the paper. There's a potential for transporter harm that can't necessarily be attributed to specific geoengineering deployments. There's difficulty in detecting geoengineering deployments in the first place, which means that there's inherently suspicion associated with the potential for deployment or ongoing deployments. There's the potential for counter geoengineering, which most papers assume that deployment occurs and that's it. And if the paper begins to discuss geoengineering, there's an assumption that the geoengineer moves towards status quo. So somebody deploys, country A deploys SAI, and country B deploys SAI back to get things back to the climate status quo before the initial deployment. But that's not necessarily true. Just because a country deploys SAI, if a country deployed SAI, there wouldn't be any inherent responsibility on a second country to move back to the status quo. The nature of geoengineering is such that it literally changes the strategic environment of international relations, in that the climate, you're literally shifting the climate in a way that's ostensibly beneficial for your state. You know, if the United States or China or Russia or whomever deployed geoengineering, it would be premised on the idea that they would benefit from its deployment. And if you're an opponent of the state that does the initial deploying, and you can't necessarily effectively measure the transborder harms, you can't necessarily measure the deployment itself, and you don't necessarily have faith that the long-term strategic benefits that the deploying country accrues will be spread equally across the globe, there's a real chance that you would want to counter this potentially enormous strategic shift, because depending on how deployment occurred and how the impacts were assessed across the planet, you could find a real shift in the environmental conditions in your home country that were potentially caused by the deployment of geoengineering. And so in order to preempt that, you would take steps, whether that's counter geoengineering or kinetic activities against the deploying state, because you can't trust that there would be ostensibly a mean global good, but the inequality in the ultimate outcomes and the long timeline before you would actually know what the outcomes are sort of put pressure on states to act to preempt the potential negative impacts much earlier than you would find the ultimate positive impacts accruing.
Well, let me just interject on a few points there. So I wrote a paper a long time ago called Geoengineering, a War on Climate Change. And that looked at various different deployment scenarios. And I think there's a couple of comments that are worth framing. So you could have the idea that all actors are selfish and that they only do what's good for them. But I think there are a couple of flaws with that model. So firstly, when people do things, they generally try to at least moderate their behavior. So it has at least a superficial impression of not being completely selfish, even if their motivations might be selfish. So if I want 3 units of geoengineering and you only want 1 unit of geoengineering and I want to start geoengineering, it makes sense for me to start with 1 unit of geoengineering because it won't upset you, right? So I think that all states have an incentive to moderate what they're doing to the extent that unnecessary conflict is prevented, because a bit of cooling is probably going to be good for a large number of people. A great deal of cooling is probably not going to be good for many people. And there's some ideologues that you're always going to upset, but they're not necessarily going to be that powerful or important or influential. But I think it's worth looking at a few state situations which might be where the idea of a unilateral actor is more relevant. So this is drawing from what I've written in my paper on Geoengineering, a War on Climate Change, which I think it came out in the Journal of Evolution and Technology about 8 or 10 years ago. And that was looking at the following scenario. So you had a kind of superpower actor like the US, where you got kind of hegemonic, I think, never remember which of the two it is, control. So basically people can't really do anything about it. But equally, if you look at the history of the United States, I'm not saying it's a wonderful country that's always benign in its motives, but you know, you can draw a comparison between Finland joining NATO versus Ukraine joining Russia. One is a much more pleasant experience than the other, right? It's not necessarily a country that has made its successful quasi-empire based on always being belligerent to get its own way. There's another example where you might have a country which you kind of might think of as the sort of Tuvalu model or the Bangladesh model, which is someone that's got nothing to lose. So while Tuvalu is an archetypal case where a country is facing essentially destruction, Bangladesh is a more realistic example. It's a much larger country. It's much more technologically able, and therefore it's much more likely that a country like Bangladesh would have the means to incept geoengineering. And then finally, you've got what you might call a sort of technocratic rogue state, with Israel being a fairly good example of a country which is somewhat impervious to international condemnation with a high degree of technological sophistication. And they might seek to start geoengineering in a somewhat tin-eared fashion, but where they've got some degree of military capability to back it up. And also the perceived technocratic capability to do the job quite well. So even if you don't like Israel and you don't, like Israel's SRM policy, even a detractor might say they'll probably make a fairly good job of it. And a state which is making a hash of it is probably somebody you want to intervene with more than someone that you just don't like who's doing it quite well. So I think there are nuances and subtleties about who will or won't do it, how much they will or won't do, and what incentives there might be on people to attack metaphorically or literally a country that's doing geoengineering. So I just wonder if I could ask you to reflect on those points and see how that meshes in with what you've written.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you're suggesting is that there's an awareness of doing it right or wrong and an understanding of the outcomes of the deployment itself, which...
Well, to break it down, so there's right and wrong in terms of, you know, just doing it badly, for example, like, you know, cat-handed deployment, which was, you know, for example, not balanced interhemispherically. So it's not a case of whether you're doing too much or too little. It's just whether what you're doing is being done right. You know, you might not be monitoring it and things like that, right? And I think that there'd be a lot more pressure on states who just can't do it properly than there would be for an equivalent amount of intervention from somebody who is capable of doing it very competently, right? So you might, you know, contrast, say, Ghana versus France, for example, right? You kind of assume that France would bring more technological expertise and industrial complexity to the process than Ghana might be able to, right? So people might trust the French to do it in a way that they might not trust the Ghanaians to do it. So
I mean, that is potentially true, but that also assumes that what the French are doing is the right thing to do in the first place. So we wouldn't know, based on the current modeling, the current technology, we wouldn't know the French were doing it right to begin with for quite a long time. And the French would be inherently reliant on the cooperation of the rest of the world to allow them to keep going until they got to a point at which everyone was happy with the conditions.
And well, that often comes up in arguments. So let me give you a counterpoint to that, because I don't find that argument fully persuasive. The point that I think is worth recognizing when that kind of stuff is considered is the concept of limited political capital. So it's all very well to say, well, states would do this if another state did that. But at the end of the day, you can only have so many fights with people. And states are generally arguing with each other about stuff all the time in various different ways. And they've only got so many thing, there's only so many hands that you can pull levers with. You might have a lot of levers, but you don't always have the hands to place on those levers, right? Mm-hmm. And so if someone's upset with France because they're geoengineering, they might also be upset with France because they are, for example, you know, taking some kind of military or diplomatic action that they don't approve of. And the whole thing is basically got to be geared around balancing the resources you've got to bear politically and militarily with the things you've got to deploy them on. And, you know, while a lot of people might not like a lot of things that France does, they can't do much about them because there's only a limited amount of resources they've got to invest in arguing with France, right? And if the French are doing an industrially competent geoengineering operation, and they're doing that in a way which isn't completely reckless with the global climate, so they're doing a limited amount of geoengineering, and they're doing it technically quite competently, it's hard to see why Botswana or Bolivia or Bhutan might get especially cross with the French, right?
Well, I mean, any one of those countries might suffer incredible climatological shifts that we can't predict at this point. And so if France is doing a technically competent job so that the global mean temperature is being reduced, but, you know, an enormous number of countries are suffering transborder harm that because of it, they're suffering serious weather phenomena or shifts in disease vectors such that, you know.
How likely is that? I mean, like, isn't it the point of this? Or is making things better?
We don't know how likely that is, and that's why the risk of interstate tension is so high, is because the potential for transborder harm the scope of geoengineering is literally global, and so the potential for transborder harm against any number of countries is real and is undetermined at this point. And so a technically correct and a geoengineering deployment that meets the letter of what it's intended to do in terms of reducing global mean temperatures doesn't necessarily absolve the actor from, you know, the fact that they're now killing people. Their actions have resulted in the deaths of people all around the planet. And, you know, in that scenario, what we're dealing with is potentially the alignment of numerous countries against the actor.
Well, let me explain why I think that might not be the case, because what you're basically saying is, if I'm kind of taking your argument at its highest, you're basically saying that there's a hypothetical risk that SRM will be highly damaging to a range of nations, and therefore people are going to want to intervene in that process to stop it. But climate change is also very damaging, and it's not just sort of hypothetically damaging, it's definitely damaging, and it's been going on for a long time, and it's very, very clear that certain countries are very much worse at it than others, and people all around the world are suffering dire consequences. But the response isn't to, you know, engage in threats, kinetic or otherwise, on those accounts. It's basically to ask nicely. And I'm not sure why it's seen that SRM as being a more of a trigger than climate change would be. I mean, like,
so, you know, climate change is the result of systemic action, right? So, like, it is not just one individual distinct problem caused by an individually distinct cause, right? You know, it's personal transportation and energy production and manufacturing and all of these things that jointly contribute to climate change. Whereas SRM is a distinct cause that, if you had negative outcomes of it, could theoretically point to the negative outcome, the causality of SRM, and demand that be halted.
Yeah, to paraphrase what you're saying, it's a deliberate action, not a side effect, right?
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily think that makes it something that people are more likely to engage in direct hostility about. I mean, you could take a country like, for example, Tuvalu or Bangladesh and their vulnerability. Now, you know, the Tuvaluans or however you pronounce it, they don't fly airliners into skyscrapers in America because the Americans engage in a lot of climate pollution, right? It's not beyond the... There's a great quote from Pablo Escobar. It's a terrorism is the atomic bomb of poor people. It's the only way the poor have to strike back. If you want to look for a kinetic threat, then looking at where terrorism is associated with climate change action is a good place to start. And there just really isn't any. And I understand what you're saying about the side effects. And I understand it's systemic and I understand it's more global. But I think the idea that people would, if SRM was deployed in a way which
we're talking about states and the
point. Well, I understand that, but states are made of people. But if I just finish this key point, if I may, what I'm saying is I think that if there was a track record of violent action around climate change, it would be far more easy to understand that there's likely to be a track record of violence to come around SRM. And I think that the fact that people don't typically engage in violence against the perpetrators of climate change, I mean, I understand climate change may exacerbate wars, but that's not direct. It's not like directly against the people who are changing the climate. And I think that in defense of SRM, I think that the fact that SRM is ostensibly done in a sort of at least superficially benign fashion, people are doing it because they want to make things better, not because it's not a weapon. You're not actively trying to make it worse for people. You're trying to make things better, but you might make things better in a rather uneven or unfair way. And I think the idea that you mentioned kinetic threats earlier, the idea that people are sort of suddenly going to escalate to kinetic threats as opposed to grumbling with diplomacy and petitioning people and sanctions and all of that, it just seems a bit James Bond, really. It doesn't look like necessarily the way that this sort of stuff might happen.
I'm not concerned with my argument isn't concerned with necessarily the feelings of the people of Tuvalu. My concerns are that if a state like the United States engages in geoengineering, and it's even if it's ostensibly for superficially bettering the world, and the government of China feels that the negative climate implications of that have been sufficient, they would go to war with the United States. Because, you know, I can imagine a condition where the climatological shifts in central China produce massive famines, and that in and of itself is sufficient to serve as pressure on the government of China. I'm not arguing necessarily that individuals or even small collectives are going to find the geoengineering as a reason for them to take action to try and bomb the airfields where the sprayer planes are located or something like that. That's not what I'm arguing. What I'm arguing is that if the transborder harm from a state actor like the United States or China was sufficient, if the Chinese engaged in unilateral geoengineering deployments and the United States suffered a wave of extreme climate-related weather, for instance, I can see that as being pressure point on the United States to try and take action against the Chinese. Whether it would be kinetic or not, I'm unwilling to say because I just don't know. But I can certainly see there being a massive push by the United States to try and end the unilateral geoengineering deployment of the Chinese, just because they are feeling the negative impacts. And just because China says that their deployment is for the global good doesn't mean the United States isn't going to try and stop it if the government of the United States feels that the United States specifically is suffering negative impacts. So it's not really a question of, you know, one person or a small country like Tuvalu or Bangladesh trying to stop geoengineering or start geoengineering, because they really don't have the practical capabilities to engage in it in the first place or to stop it if it's being deployed by the United States. But
Bangladesh probably might do. I mean, it's not inconceivable that a contractor, like a kind of slightly more organized version of Make Sunsets, might not come to Bangladesh and say, hey, your country's going to be underwater. We can sort it out if you give us this amount of money. That doesn't sound to me to be wholly implausible.
I mean, maybe not. I think it would be an enormous amount of money, but the problem is that that's still an issue of like those countries, the those contractors would have to find a base of operations that would allow them to continue their operations. They would have to have the fleet, to maintain the fleet. They would have to have the permissions of the international community to operate. A country like Bangladesh, even if they can pay a contractor to do it, which I don't necessarily think is true, would still have to deal with the consequences of blowback. And so if a place like Bangladesh finds the means to pay someone to do geoengineering on their behalf, but then the implications are, say, that there's transborder harm in India, such that the, you know, Himalayan water resources are particularly constrained, I can see the Indian government taking steps to try and squash Bangladeshi geoengineering. Again, whether or not that's kinetic is unclear, but like it would depend on the nature of the deployment and how it was being managed. But it's not an issue, again, of like being able to fund a deployment or to try and bomb an individual, an individual plane or something like that. We're talking about the potential for serious transborder harm to create pressure on state governments to act against it. And there's multiple conditions under which that could very easily come into play. And I'm sure that at first it would be there would certainly be an effort to maintain diplomacy and to try and work through the deployment, to talk it out, to try and reach some mitigating measures, or to scale it down slowly or whatever. But if the implications are so severe, it certainly would put pressure on governments to act strongly. And because it would take, it's a cumulative action, the beneficial impacts of geoengineering take time to be realized. If the negative impacts outpace the positive accumulation of geoengineering, the negatives are going to outweigh the potential unforeseen positives much faster. And the pressure to end it will be fairly strong, I'm sure.
So the scenarios that you're describing, how do you envisage they are going to arise? Like, I mean, if China really wanted to do geoengineering, then surely it would be quite a long, slow process of winning round the Americans, because it wouldn't make any sense for them to just go and do it and risk upsetting the Americans when...
That's what I'm arguing, is that, in fact, that if China wants to do it, what they should do is go through the long, slow process of winning over the Americans and the rest of the international community. If they choose not to, if they feel that the implications of climate change are so severe that immediate action must be taken, and they take steps to engage in this because they have done climate modeling that says, you know, X amount of sulfuric molecules that deployed in this manner will create conditions that, you know, basically keep China safe and allow them to maintain their agricultural production at the level at which they need, they would deploy it unilaterally. And that's the key thing, is individual state actions outside of the agreement of the international community. Presuming agreement by the international community on the deployment is one of those things that occurs routinely in the existing literature, but is not necessarily something that's going to happen. There's a lot of governments that have a lot of money and interests in maintaining the status quo. And then at the same time, there's a lot of governments that have interest in potentially pushing for geoengineering without mitigation. And, you know, so reaching consensus on the nature of deployment is going to be, would be incredibly difficult. But unilateral or even multilateral action that is occurring at the expense of like powerful opponents really risks elevating contention very, very rapidly.
But is it that likely that people are going to engage? My thinking is that a much more realistic path of deployment would be a kind of informal consensus building. So it wouldn't necessarily be an international vote, but what you'd probably have is a couple of states that were heavily engaged in the process. You might find, for example, Britain and America were quite pro geoengineering for whatever reason. And then they went and talked to France and Germany to get some kind of support. And then they went and announced it as a plan to the Chinese, and the Chinese said they did or didn't like it, and then the plan would get revised and toned down. You know, how do you go from that process, which it seems to be a fairly logical collaborative process, to a sort of deadlock where no one can agree on what they want to do, and one person just goes and does it? That doesn't necessarily seem to be. I can't see an obvious path of how you get from consensus to conflict, because it seems to me that in all reasonable circumstances, it would make more sense to try and go along with the consensus, however imperfect it was, than to get into a big squabble. Because this sort of cuts to the central point, right? Because these states have a lot of things they might want to fight about, you know, trade, fishing rights, passage for military ships in the South China Sea, all of these kind of things. There's a lot of reasons why they don't want to have an argument about this one specific thing. So how do you envisage they go from a situation of having a chummy chat to, you know,
well, but that's exactly the point, right? Like, consensus, you're exactly right. Consensus building would be the most logical, most peaceful, and most effective mechanism. But consensus building on issues that have global implications require sacrifice by countries and potentially have impact, negative consequences for individual states, is incredibly difficult. Things that it's not that geoengineering, just we all have to talk about it until we reach a level in which we're all comfortable. You have to talk to states with the presumption that there will be negative consequences for those states if they engage in this, and that individual states have to accept their willingness to swallow that. And for some states, that may be insufficient. They might be unwilling to do that, and which is why contentious international issues don't get resolved through consensus, even though you would think they would. Like fishing rights in the South China Sea is,
well, let me explain
something that could be resolved through international consensus. But I would say that
can I just pick that one point up, because I think it's really important. You used an example, and I think it's a very weak example, because the point of fishing rights is that if I have a right to fish, you do not, fundamentally. Now, there might be sort of some areas where we have overlapping rights, but two people cannot eat the same fish, okay? Mm-hmm. Whereas in SRM, that you don't have this natural competitive conflict, that you can have a solution that's fundamentally.
We don't know what we have under SRM. So you're like, would the government of the UK be willing to say that the implication that they are willing to swallow geoengineering if it makes the, you know, it basically creates climate conditions that make the Midlands uninhabitable, and such that they have to change the demographics of the country and the nature of the domestic infrastructure and a number of other massive structural and societal changes to accept geoengineering, and potentially like creates conditions that make living in parts of the country uninhabitable, or otherwise changes things that makes it difficult to live under the current conditions. It's not that specific things get taken from people under geoengineering. What it is that there is a potential for unforeseen risk that a state has to be willing to accept in order to agree to the deployment. And since nobody currently can articulate what individual states would have to suffer, you have to presume that you would potentially eat the worst, you could suffer the worst impossible impacts. Because if you don't, then you have you do have the worst possible impacts under the SRM deployment, you potentially have to, you're going to be under immense pressure to respond to that and to detail why your government allowed that to happen.
Well, I take your point that if that sort of stuff did happen, then yes, it would be flashpoint for conflict. But the question I have is really how realistic that is. Is it that likely that the Midlands would become uninhabitable? Now, obviously, you know, Picking the example of Britain, it's very unlikely that would happen because there's no geophysical reason to think that the Midlands would become uninhabitable. But I take your point. It doesn't detract from your point that it's geophysically unrealistic for my specific country. But the theoretical argument that in a country, there could be great local disadvantages for geoengineering, I don't find that that is a hypothetically implausible argument. But what I'm saying is I think that it's a fairly practically implausible argument because, firstly, I don't think that there are, I don't know, and I, you know, I'm not saying I'm the kind of world's greatest SRM expert by any means, but from what I understand of the literature, it's not thought to be a very sort of high, what you might call flashpoint concentration, where, you know, you get a very strong winners and losers situation. I think what's perhaps much more realistic is that you get a random variation of winners and losers as a result of climate, full stop. In that, well, some people have good years and bad years, and then you blame it on people you don't like. And
well, exactly. You blame it on people you don't like. Exactly. You blame it on people you don't like. But yeah, I mean, the thing is that the ultimate localized implications of geoengineering are unknown. So modeling broadly deals with global means, and it's idealized to represent the, you know, a single individual pathways, and it is incapable of articulating sort of the impacts for individual countries on a fairly discrete and specific basis. So maybe the Midlands don't become uninhabitable, but for a country like the United States or China, where you have substantial geographic variation, there's a fairly strong likelihood that there would be significant negative impacts to at least part of the country. And so if that hits an area where the country is highly dependent on for agricultural production, that's a potentially substantial impact to that country's ability to function. And so it's when you ask about whether or not it's likely, the answer is that we just don't know. And that's where the potential for conflict comes in, is that the unknown of the impact allows for states to both blame the deployment and the deployer, but also it allows for them to assume the worst for their political purposes, whether or not it's true. So,
Let's pick the example of America. So let's assume, and I don't think this is realistic, but let's just assume for the purpose of this conversation that you have like a dust bowl like condition in the Midwest as a result of geoengineering. But if that were to happen, then you might also have people in Arizona saying, well, you know, we're not getting so many deadly heat waves now, so it's quite good. So the point I'm making is there's not going to be a kind of homogeneous response of all communities within a country to geoengineering at any level. And therefore, the idea that all of this ire is going to be directed externally against the Chinese is, in my view, not necessarily right, because a lot of that would be a case of, well, it would be more likely that people would say, well, you know, our representatives in Washington have allowed the interests of the Arizonans to take precedence over the interests of people in the Midwest. And we ought to be shouting at the people in Washington to represent our interests more effectively to the Chinese. Now, it's a somewhat more nuanced point than China bad. I get it. And, you know, if you're predisposed to China bad, then you might be very persuaded by the messaging of Chinese people are awful and they're changing our weather. But not everybody's an idiot. And people do recognize that politics happens on a number of different tiers. And if, you know, one of the tiers is your local representation is not doing a very effective job at getting your national government to put the case to China for a bit less geoengineering or a bit more geoengineering, then you're likely to go first and foremost to ring up your elected representative rather than going to the Chinese embassy and throwing eggs at it or whatever, right? So I just think that there's a lot more nuance to this than the idea that you've game theoretic states that have only got one policy to worry about and they act as monolithic blocks. That's just not really how anything happens in the real world. We did skip an essential step earlier. Obviously, the paper's on the podcast link, but nevertheless, if you could give us the title of the paper, who it was published by, and where who you worked with, the sort of like little potted history of the paper and how it came to be, that would be great.
Yeah. So the paper is called Avoiding Atmospheric Anarchy, Geoengineering as a Source of Interstate Tension. It was published in the journal Environment and Security. Like you said, the link is in the show notes. I didn't really work with anyone on this. Like I said, I'm not a geoengineering guy. Technically, I'm not a climatologist. I'm a security guy. In the course of my doctoral work, I was looking at some other stuff and came across geoengineering and sort of went down a little bit of a rabbit hole. And as I was looking at it more and more, my questions about sort of how states would resolve questions of transborder harm, the potential for blaming unaccountable harm, led me to sort of begin to think about what the implications for state interactions under geoengineering would be. And the more I read about, particularly with regard to counter geoengineering, and the presumption that the movement would be towards status quo as opposed towards the individual state interests, led me to sort of develop out the piece as it is, so where I lay out a number of scenarios for potential conflict under two certain conditions. One is more or less controllability of geoengineering technology, and the other is the presence or absence of counter geoengineering as a capability.
Well, counter geoengineering is interesting. I mean, my sort of initial take on counter geoengineering is that it's a bit like strategic nuclear weapons in that they're almost it's almost designed to be useless. Like, there's no real scenario where these strategic nuclear weapons make sense, right? And they haven't been used for 70 years. And even though obviously nuclear bombs have been used in conflict, they're nothing like the scale of the generations of nuclear weapons that came after them, right? And counter geoengineering to me seems the first order, a bit like that. There's never a situation where you'd want counter geoengineering and solar radiation management to exist at the same time, right? It benefits nobody for that to have that happen. And the only reason it would happen is just a complete breakdown of negotiation. And it seems to me that the incentives for agreement are so high, and the incentives for disagreement are, relatively speaking, so low, that counter geoengineering can't exist as anything other than a theoretical threat, right? So would you agree that that's the case, or do you genuinely think that counter geoengineering might conceivably occur?
No, I think counter geoengineering is a real possibility, because I imagine a conditions under which the United States develops a geoengineering capability and the government in Beijing or in Moscow develops a counter geoengineering capability simply because they do not want the United States to be able to dictate the global climate conditionality.
Well, they might develop the capability, but would the development of that capability preclude the use of not only counter geoengineering, but also ordinary geoengineering? Because counter geoengineering to me seems to only work as a threat and not as a technology.
I mean, nobody knows if any of this works as a technology, but...
But what I mean is it does work. I've literally got a paper out today on it, in preprint only, I might add, but it's just going on. If people don't follow me on Geoengineering1 on Twitter, please do so. It's where we release news of all kinds of things. It's not a personal account. It's it's where we use as an information account for the whole community. And that's where I found out about my own paper, in fact, which had gone to preprint and I hadn't known about it when my staff found it and posted it up online today. I hadn't done anything to announce it personally, but it had gone out on the staff send out to everybody. So all of us at Geoengineering1 on Twitter if you want to keep up with the latest news. But yeah, so we've got a counter geoengineering paper up today, and that looks at the use of counter geoengineering for volcanoes. Basically, if the world gets too cold because of a natural event, and you can use it to counter geoengineering to fix the problem, as it were. So as a technology, it's very real, but the point I'm making, so are nuclear weapons. Like, if you go and fire a nuclear missile, it will go off.
But we have nuclear missiles. We don't have the capability to deploy geoengineering, and we haven't done it at scale, even for testing purposes. And we certainly haven't done counter geoengineering at scale for testing purposes. So it's I mean, there's been a lot of research, but there's a difference between blowing something up with the nuclear weapon for real and doing the modeling on whether or not it would blow up. And same for geoengineering. Like,
well, my point to be clear is very simple, right? That I think that the idea that we'll actually do counter geoengineering as opposed to talking about it or building the capability to do it, it is very unlikely. It's useful as a tool to force people to negotiate. It isn't directly useful as a technology to counter climate geoengineering that incepts cooling.
I think that would be the primary use. Yeah, would be as an inhibition to anybody to engage in geoengineering initially. But I don't necessarily think that if a state had the capability to engage in counter geoengineering and another state preemptively engaged in geoengineering, that the counter geoengineer would not act. I don't think that that is true. I think that if in an idealized scenario where everybody talks to each other and is honest, then yes, I'm sure that the geoengineer and the counter geoengineer could reach detente and say, okay, we'll figure something else out. But that's not necessarily true. And if the pressure for response to climate change became sufficient that a geoengineer engaged in unilateral action or even sort of multilateral action at the expense of other states, I can see the counter geoengineer taking steps to deploy it in response. I don't think that it's entirely outside the realm of possibility.
Well, I think it might be deployed in a kind of symbolic basis as a kind of brinkmanship. But I think the idea of you've got a stable situation where one country is cracking on with 5 years of solar geoengineering and the other one is cracking on with 5 years of counter geoengineering, that doesn't seem to me to be a viable situation.
Well, no, I don't think that's a good situation either. But I think that that's one of the scenarios I detail in the paper, which is that essentially because one state engages in geoengineering unilaterally to serve their own interests, and the second state engages in counter geoengineering because they believe that the climatological conditions established by the initial geoengineering deployment are a net negative for them, they engage in counter geoengineering and it becomes an escalatory spiral where both negative climate implications and potentially kinetic engagement become very real. And I don't necessarily think that that is a likely scenario. It is certainly, in my mind, a pretty apocalyptic scenario, actually. But I don't necessarily also think it's outside the realm of possibility where if we are unable to engage in sufficient mitigation and climate conditions in the world become substantially negative, that states begin to engage in climate geoengineering to mitigate climate change without international consensus on what it looks like. And once that happens, the potential for counter and geoengineering as a legitimate deployment becomes very real, I think.
So you basically envisage some sort of kind of international bun fight. It's like an all against all wedding brawl, basically.
No, I wouldn't say that. If we were able to develop a much more controllable set of technologies that allowed for localized conditions where people were able to engage in geoengineering that allowed improved localized climate conditions, then maybe something like that would be possible. Far more likely in sort of the worst case scenario is the broad scope deployment where essentially you've got two waves of geoengineering efforts going across the planet and everybody suffers the consequences for it.
So what's the analysis method that you use to derive your conclusions? Have you just done this by basic reasoning? Have you done some kind of mathematical model or game theory approach, or what have you approached it?
It's just scenario based. The argument is entirely premised on a number of on the development of a series of scenarios based around the two conditionalities, which is presence or absence of geoengineering, and the viability of controlling the geoengineering deployment technologically, as opposed to just like spraying it in the atmosphere and letting natural drift control it. So I didn't model anything. Like I said, I'm not a climatologist. I can't pretend that I could do the modeling. I'm certainly open to trying to develop these out into much more robust models, but essentially it's just a qualitative reasoning based on scenario development.
So are you looking only at stratospheric sulfur engineering? You're talking about geographical variation. So are you considering also marine cloud brightening or what?
For the purposes of the paper, it's just SAI. It's just stratospheric aerosol injection. I do think that things like marine cloud brightening also potentially have risks. I don't really explore them here. You know, that's a different sort of situation where we're talking about localized implications. And in that sort of scenario, I can certainly see a lot of the same things coming forward, where the potential for transporter harm in localized conflicts becomes very real and becomes a much bigger problem. You know, you mentioned Israel earlier. I can certainly see the Israelis engaging in sort of localized climate modification if the technology were available, and that sort of thing escalating tensions in the region. But I focus only on SAI for the purposes of this paper. Yeah.
Now you focused on the conflict potential or the militarization of the technology itself, right? But what about the peripheral technologies? I think one thing that I think is missing from the literature, and I'd be interested in publishing one if anybody listening or you are interested in working on it, is the militarization of the infrastructure. So, for example, you might have a situation where SAI planes are given kind of international free passage, but they might be used as cover for spying, or they might be weaponized, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of situations you can imagine where the actual infrastructure itself is weaponized. Is that something it may not have been some of your paper touched on, but you may have opinions about it anyway?
Well, I do touch on it. I think that, so two things. One, I think that you highlighted one of the reasons why I think that tension is potentially real, is that the globalized nature of the deployment sort of invites suspicion about the nature of the technology. So planes would have to fly over potentially hostile states, and those states would be inherently suspicious about the nature of the deployment. So, you know, the United States can say that our geoengineering planes are just engaged in geoengineering, but if we fly over Russia, the Russians are going to be hard-pressed to believe that we don't have surveillance packages on board those planes. Speaking towards the militarization of the technology, I think it's certainly a concern, and other authors have talked about this much more fulsomely, but there really is the possibility, as this would require substantial bureaucratization and, you know, capability to maintain a pretty robust fleet of aircraft or whatever the deploying technology is, there's a very strong possibility that it would be centralized in the military. And so that in and of itself is inherently potentially concerning for opponents of geoengineering or states that are opposed to a specific geoengineering deployment.
Certainly that's considered as being an option by a lot of commentators, but how realistic is it? I mean, the military isn't that heavily involved in the early discussions. There are commercial outfits that are doing or attempting to do geoengineering at the moment.
Yeah, there are certainly commercial efforts that are underway, but in terms of the nature of the deployment as it's been envisioned by most folks, it would require a substantial bureaucratic infrastructure, and it would be we're talking hundreds, if not thousands, of people maintaining regular deployments, which means maintenance of the aircraft, which means development of the aircraft, which means testing and monitoring of the deployments, testing and monitoring of the impacts, reporting on this, you know, all of the associated things that come with that. So, you know, we're talking human resources devoted to geoengineering personnel. We're talking pay. We're talking, you know, the folks that handle paychecks and that sort of stuff, the folks that handle internal complaints management and these sorts of things. So the military becomes a very sort of easy mechanism for states to overcome all of those things because they're already in place inside the military. And rather than grow an entirely new bureaucratic wing devoted specifically to geoengineering, which is possible.
Well, yeah, let me give you an example. Let me give you a supportive example where I think what you're saying has occurred. So the Army Corps of Engineers in the US, they do a lot of things like dam construction maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some logic to doing that because it allows them to deploy large numbers of people in dangerous situations at short notice, and they basically are not allowed to complain about it. That's sort of the nature of what being in the military is, you know, go walk into that horrible situation. Yes, sir, right? It's not like, you know, normally you get a kind of union labor that says, no, we're not doing that because it's not our shift, it's Sunday. So there is a precedent for doing this kind of thing, but SAI is a more mundane enterprise than that kind of thing. And I think it's likely, in my view, that you'd have a much more, it'd be much more similar to countries' environmental bureaucracies in terms of the typical processes that might be put in place to manage sewage or check river quality or, you know,
it would certainly make a degree of sense to place it with the environmental management, whatever a country's environmental management, you know, agencies are. But the nature of the platforms leads me to believe that at least there would be a pull towards the military. That's not to say that it's absolutely guaranteed that it would be located within the military. I just think that there's a strong possibility that leadership, if they were trying to develop something like this, would look towards the military as a sort of a stopgap or easily as an easy button.
I think I get to a similar conclusion to you by a different route and with different implications. I think it's very likely that the military, there'll be a crossover in terms of technology in that if you can put geoengineering chemicals on an aircraft, you can put a bomb on it, right? Mm-hmm. And so the kind of platforms that would be necessary to do geoengineering would be similar to the kind of platforms that you would use for military purposes, particularly kind of long duration spy planes. They're very similar to, and there are already platforms that are, they're called HAPS. There's a whole category of aviation called HAPS, which is mm-hmm. high altitude platform systems, and they sort of fly around and carry antenna and optics and things like that around the world for various purposes, both good and evil. And the military crossover there is that you know, the military tend to want to do similar things to what stratospheric geoengineers want to do. But in terms of the bureaucracy, but other reasons, you know, there are lots of other places with HR departments. You don't need to use the army because you want a convenient HR department. And also, you're not doing any of this in a hurry, right? You know, even a hasty deployment of geoengineering might be, say, 5 years, right? And mm-hmm. people envisage it in some cases, but, you know, not even starting for 30, 40 years, right? So there's no rush to get it done on Tuesday. And so I can't see the institutional pressure to do it quickly that might otherwise be the case, right? So I don't find it wholly plausible that the reasons that you've given for militarization are going to be the reasons that are, in practical terms, used for militarization. I think there are some crossover aspects, but they're much more based on platform capability than they are on other aspects.
Well, I'm not trying to argue that the military would be guaranteed to get it. I think that there would be pull towards putting it with the military for a number of reasons, but I can also see it going with, like, for instance, in the United States, something like the EPA or somebody like that. But what I would be cautious of is something that you've mentioned a couple times now, which is sort of would be cross-platforming, so that either military aircraft, existing military aircraft are modified to be geoengineering aircraft, or geoengineering aircraft are fitted out with additional capabilities that are hostile.
Let's look at cross-platforming at the moment. Well, hold on. Let's break this down, because this is really important, and this is going to be genuinely new because there's not been much published on this, and I happen to have a bit of knowledge in this area. So I'm going to sort of get a bit excited about this and go on about this for a moment. Cross-platforming is there are two aspects to it. So like NASA's Sabre flights, for example, they're taking a military aircraft, the U-2, that is still, I think, in current use, but not very actively. It's not really like kind of what people... Mostly it's all spy satellites now, but they've just got legacy aircraft that are used for specific tasks. And that is a kind of repurposing. But that aircraft is not a military aircraft in its current form. It's a military airframe, but it's not got any military capabilities on it when NASA is using it. Now, in theory, you could put spy cameras on it and have like a geoengineering monitoring aircraft that's actually a military airframe and fly it around. But I think it's much more likely that you'd have a more modern set of geoengineering aircraft, which were sort of developed with an eye on military customers and an eye on civilian customers. That's that one aspect of the cross-platforming. The second aspect is the more sort of covert aspect. And I think this is something that becomes much more relevant over a much longer period of time, in that if you have to have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of aircraft flying around in the stratosphere to monitor your geoengineering program, sampling the air and making sure that, you know, things are being done as they should be and the environmental effects are what we think they are, then the situation that you are envisaging is one where you've got a natural degree of cover for any espionage activity that you might want to undertake, or any sort of military capability. Like, you might want to make sure that you've always got bombs over enemy territory, right? Now, you could say, well, look, I mean, people fly airliners around the world all the time and they're not militarized. That's true, but they've also got a lot of people on board, and there's a much bigger infrastructure around maintaining them, and more people need access to them. So if you're going to hide something that's related to espionage or defense, you probably don't want to hide it on a civil plane, not monitoring equipment. Obviously, spies would travel around, human resources would travel around on commercial airliners all the time, but that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about like actually putting sensing equipment or weapons onto the aircraft. The idea that you could do that on a kind of conventional Boeing is not very likely, but a plane that's been developed with high performance in a very tight supply chain, maybe owned and operated by a single company, doesn't have much in the way of federal inspection because it's not used to carry passengers. It's far more realistic that something like that might be used as a cover for spying than it is to imagine that your kind of flight to Magaluf is going to end up being used as a cover for spying, right? So I think that building an infrastructure around the use of these aircraft does raise security concerns, but these are not concerns. These are concerns peripheral to the core mission of stratospheric aerosol intervention. They're not based around the actual injection itself. They're based around the monitoring and deployment infrastructure that is undergoing a separate purpose. Now, I'm genuinely not aware of much literature in this field. I do have some professional involvement in this sort of sectors, but I can understand how this sort of stuff might arise. But are you aware of people who've specifically considered those issues of both cross-platform and covert use in the security literature or not?
No, in fact, I don't think that, I mean, I'm not aware of any. I don't think, to your point, I don't think that there's been very much discussed about it. I certainly think that you're exactly right in that there would be great temptation for governments that are deploying these to take advantage of the nature of the deployment to see what they could do adjacent to the SAI deployment. I'm not, similar to you, I'm not tracking any literature that touches on that as a specific issue. And I do think it's one of those things that would be immediately of concern. It would be the sort of thing that wouldn't necessarily come up initially in the discussions between states on this issue, but would immediately become a concern once the deployments were in place and the planes were overhead. People would suddenly be asking very, very pointed questions in that direction for sure. So it would be, I think it would be certainly worth sort of diving in a little bit onto what the associated security implications would be for sure. I think that's at least worth some exploration for sure. And I don't think anybody is doing it.
Well, we should do a paper on it then, because it hasn't been considered in my mind the sort of incidental or peripheral aspects of security. Even the paper that I did that specifically about security, so radiation management geoengineering, which went into a lot of depth and detail about how protest or cyber attack or kinetic attack might affect geoengineering infrastructure. None of that was based on an understanding of how you could have this sort of covert or dual use technology. None of that is considered in my knowledge as prominently within the existing literature. So
needs
to have some work done on it, in my view.
I would agree.
Okay. So what haven't we covered in your paper? What do we need to discuss that we haven't yet talked about?
I don't know. I think we've gone pretty far over it. I don't want to necessarily detail the individual scenarios as they're listed in the paper, because that's, you know, they get into sort of different hypotheticals, but we've covered the nature of the conditions more or less. So yeah, I think we've covered essentially the broadest scopes of the paper.
So could you talk to us more about the wider context of your work? What else do you do? How does it fit in? What are you planning in the future?
Yeah, so like I said, this was part of my doctoral work. One of the things that I've been interested in, most of my work professionally has been related to Africa, actually. And I got very interested in the nature of Chinese technological engagement on the continent of Africa and how technological outreach produces technological lock-in. And so this was incredibly tangential to it. But one of the things that this research has led me to get very interested in, and something I'm hoping to pursue in the future, is the nature of competitive adaptation between states as mitigation efforts are, if mitigation efforts are insufficient, I think that one of the things that we're going to see going forward is security tensions emerging from individual states engaging in climate adaptive mechanisms domestically that have downstream implications for other states. Geoengineering, I think, is probably the most
like building dams, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Building dams, but, you know, forestation, these sorts of things, which ostensibly seem potentially in some cases beneficial, but have implications that are unforeseen and produce interstate tension. Yeah, building dams is a very visible mechanism for this. And geoengineering is another one in terms of just like the highly visible nature of it. But I think there are probably some less visible adaptive mechanisms that are on the horizon that have the potential to create interstate tension. And I'm really hoping to dig into that in the future as well.
Where do you work and who do you work with?
So I am an employee of the United States government, and I work in D.C.
Have you got an institutional affiliation on the paper, or is it just published in your own name?
It's just published on my own name.
So what future work have you got planned in this area? Are you planning to publish more in the field, or what?
Yeah, I mean, I have to do this sort of as an extracurricular activity, because it's not the primary focus of my day-to-day. But I'm hoping, like I said, to dive more into the potential for adaptive conflict, so interstate tension that emerges from state adaptation to climate change. But it's not nothing is very definite at this stage. I'm sort of drafting a couple things, but it's only in my free time, unfortunately. So I'm hoping to dive more into it, but it's slow going.
The whole field of SAI is sustained on people's interest and goodwill. It's amazing how little resource. This podcast actually got described as being a main resource for the field. And the idea that the podcast that I do when I'm pottering around my house doing my laundry, and we haven't had so much as a dollar of donations to, being a main resource for the community, it's just bizarre, really. When you think about like the strategic importance of this whole field, and it just sort of depends on people doing stuff in their free time, you know, often it quite important work. You know, a lot of the gym stuff has been done by people who are not full-time paid to do it and things like that. And it's remarkable how much importance is placed on. This brings me to an interesting aside, actually. There's similar in computing. A lot of the code bases that sustain a lot of the major services that we rely on are maintained by volunteers. And one of them was recently hacked by a helpful chappie that came along and offered to do some assistance with maintaining one of these code bases. And it was actually a malicious actor and then hacked the code base and use it to break into people's systems or hoover up their data or whatever the particular malicious threat vector was. But nevertheless, the end result was that somebody was not what they seemed. And I did a little poll on @GeoEngineering1 on Twitter, which is something I'm fond of doing now and again. And people were, you know, there was a degree of concern amongst the people in the field that this sort of thing is possible within geoengineering, at least. And we should perhaps be mindful of the fact that not all helpful chappies are actually helpful. And there's at least a risk. So keep an eye out. Is your lab supervisor a spy? We all have to be mindful of that risk. Right, we've had a little chunter about security, more general and roaming rather than specific to your paper. Are you sure there's nothing that you know, pearls of wisdom, brilliant insights in your paper that you'd like to bring up?
No, I just think that the thing that I would really emphasize, and, you know, if I'm speaking to the folks that are looking at this as a real academic interest, like with real academic interest and rigor, is that just presuming everyone's goodwill in the nature of geoengineering deployment is an enormous assumption. That if you're going to make it in your paper, that's fine, but you have to be clear that's an assumption. The universal agreement on the nature of the deployment is something that you're presuming, and I think that is not necessarily going to be a given in the real world practical implications of it. And that's the thing that I'm trying to emphasize here, is that there is a possibility for the world to get to a point where they can agree on the context and nature of geoengineering as a mechanism for helping us all. But that's a slow and difficult process. And so to argue that geoengineering is just a mechanism, It just needs to be deployed and it'll be fine, is sort of missing the point that these things have to be really worked through. And if they're not, there's real risk out there associated with it.
Well, there's a great book that I read recently called The Weirdest People in the World, which is basically about the uniqueness of Western culture. And there's a real bias and blindsight in Western culture that assumes that everybody's like that, and by the standards of Western society, the rest of the world is very corrupt, very clannish, and not prone to acting in this kind of way, which is very sort of like altruistic and pro-social for outgroups that Westerners tend to spend a lot of time thinking about and doing. And it becomes very easy to exploit that if you're a bad actor, because if you've got people who are quite trusting and they come across low trust societies. So there's a story that I think it was Robert Mugabe said, that he came to visit Britain, and he said that, like, if you wanted a newspaper from Britain, you just went to a newsstand and picked one up and took it away, and people would tut at you and occasionally shout, but no one would actually do anything. And that is a very telling comment, I thought, because that really sort of emphasized the difference between a low trust and a high trust society, and that people in a high trust society act in a way which is, you know, you kind of give the kindness to strangers, right? You know, if somebody's broken down by the side of the road, you might stop and help them fix their tire or whatever. And in a lot of other countries and cultures, that kind of goodwill to strangers, even when no one's looking, might not occur. Now, that's very different from giving hospitality, because conversely, the most hospitable cultures, typically the more clannish ones. So you tend to get a lot more hospitality in a country which is traditionally more clannish, like Ireland, than you do in a country that's traditionally less clannish, like, say, Sweden, right? But the cultural differences that drive the distinct cultural landscape around the world are quite deep-seated. And I think you're quite right that a lot of authors who are in Western universities in high trust societies have this enormous cultural blind spot that they're entirely unaware of, because they kind of think that the rest of the world is like them. And if they went to, you know, Papua New Guinea or Yemen or whatever and had a look around, they'd be quickly disabused of the notion that it's all just like Washington, D.C. Not that all parts of Washington, D.C. are wonderful, but the sort of Beltway mentality is based on the kind of weird culture that we mentioned earlier. So, yeah, I do think you're right to point out that it's unwise to look at the world without reference to these cultural blind spots. But, however, I still think the fact is that there are strong incentives to collaborate. And if you think, I think it's instructive to look at the extent to which frenemies type situation can occur. So you've got the portmanteau of friend and enemy. And if you think about it, so at the moment, like, Russian weapons and American weapons are being used to kill two different sides in Ukraine, but yet you've got people on the space station who are basically dependent for their lives on full cooperation between those two countries. So that condition of shared enmity and cooperation can coexist. You know, another couple of examples that I think are instructive. So, you know, we kind of think of China and America as being superpower rivals, but you've got visa-free travel for, I mean, Britain's a very close ally of America. It's not America itself, but I don't know what the visa situation is for American citizens. But even without a visa, you can just, as any UK citizen, you can just go to China and wander around without a visa. You know, there's no, that's on a personal level, the hostility of states is very, very low. And I mean, I know they're not, it's not somebody I know personally, but I know someone who knows them personally. And they work in the Ukrainian military and are quite happy and proud to still be a Russian passport holder. They speak Russian. They're a Russian passport holder. They work for the Ukrainian military. Our capacity as humans for these complicated and often contradictory loyalties and corporations is very high. And probably one of the most distinct features of our species is that we are able to navigate these divided and complex loyalty notions. You couldn't put chimps on a subway, they'd just kill each other, right? Whereas, you know, rival gangs can, you know, you have, there are, for example, there are in their troubles in Northern Ireland, people were imprisoned with members of the opposite side. They put them in either the same corridor or even the same cell. And, you know, the level of violence wasn't to the extent, I'm not saying violence never occurred, but it was not to the level, it was not to the level that meant that was impossible. And so I think the idea that we've are always drawn and destined to escalating conflicts is just really not in human nature. And we wouldn't be able to build large, sprawling industrial civilizations if everyone was fighting with everybody else at every opportunity. We are very, very cooperative as a species compared to our near relatives in the animal kingdom. Like chimps are much more violent, gorillas are much more violent, bonobos arguably less so. But I don't want to feel this is massively off topic, because I genuinely don't believe it is. I think that humans are highly, highly predisposed to being cooperative. And we talk about violence so much and discord so much because it is really so abnormal. Yeah. And most problems get sorted out peaceably in the end. So I have high hopes for geoengineering because of that. I think that the trend and tendency of humans for low levels of conflict as a default state is helpful. But I do think we're prone as Westerners to get used to a bit less conflict in our societies than is the global average, and therefore we can get a bit complacent, as you rightly say, about, you know, the hostile intent of other nations and actors. So that is all very interesting. I don't want to sort of steamroller you on this last part, because I'm aware that you might have a few comments and stuff like that to add. But equally, you might think that my input has been unbridled brilliance, and therefore you've got nothing further to contribute. You're just sitting there in awe of my comments. But that's fairly unlikely in my experience. So is there anything you'd like to say before we wrap up, or have you just had enough? You just got bored and stopped talking?
No. I think that whether or not we're predisposed to cooperation or violence, I think on this one topic, and, you know, with regard to climate change writ large, right, there is an absolute need for cooperation and for proactive outreach among states and among people to ensure that we address these things jointly and cohesively, because the piece doing it piecemeal is going to be insufficient to overcome the impact of climate change as a problem, and doing geoengineering piecemeal runs a lot of risks. And so, you know, I hope you're right in that we are more cooperative maybe than I give us credit for, certainly more than the paper sort of implies. But
well, I actually go beyond that. I think that the necessity of cooperation in SAI might actually have an effect of fostering more general global cooperation. I think that as we move to a world which has to be more managed, in the same way that arguably nuclear weapons have created a more collaborative and peaceful world, I think SAI might also do the same thing. Because in a situation where there's so much to lose from disorder and so much to gain from not having disorder, then it's likely, I think, that these potentially destabilizing technologies actually have the reverse effect to the one that you might think is intuitive. Now, I think one of the problems with this is that it becomes, everyone likes a good story, right? And the problem is that we might be predisposed to cooperation, but we're predisposed to talking about conflict. And the problem is that bias in our thinking, we don't write great epic stories about two people who didn't really like each other, but were next door neighbors and didn't say very much for 30 years, because it doesn't make a very good story, right? So, but the reality is that most of human history, even dramatic events, when you view it like in the long-term timescale, for example, like the kind of the population replacement in the UK that happened at the end of the Romano-British period, when the Saxons came and became the dominant demographic force in the UK. When you go and look around at what happened, yeah, you know, there were a few battles and stuff like that, but there weren't, you know, massive slaughter of people. You don't find graves full of people with bashed in heads. You don't find burned down farms. It was a fairly sort of peaceful transition. And within a few hundred years, the borders have become a lot more porous, and the Romano-British start to come back into the Saxon area as workers and travellers and things like that. And it just wasn't a particularly violent transition, even though there was a big demographic change. And, you know, we love talking about great battles and epic leaders and fantastic quests, but the reality is most life is just very boring. And the reason we do talk about those things is because those are where things change and we find that change interesting. But I think stratospheric aerosol injection might be a much less interesting story when you look at it historically than it looks when we write fiction like Termination Shock and Veil. Interestingly, Neil Stephenson has been on this very podcast. And sorry, Elliot Pepper, who wrote Veil, not Neil Stephenson, who wrote Termination Shock, wrong person. Challenging Climate hosted Neil Stephenson, we hosted Elliot Pepper. And there's another book that's coming out soon. I can't remember it right now, but I did tweet about it if people are interested. There's another fiction book coming out, and we've approached the author to come on. So hopefully we'll have a forthcoming episode about that. So on that note of stories and conflict and war and cooperation and frenemies, we've probably done the subject to death, so I might let William disappear off. Is there anything else you want to say or not?
No, I just thank you. I hope you're right and that this is This is a story with a happy ending, for sure.
Well, I think I'm going to reject your paper for not being boring enough, because the truth is very boring. But the problem is, if you like boring things, people don't want to publish it, academic or otherwise. So on that rather speculative pretext, I'm going to chuck it out of the Reviewer 2 window with you still clutching onto it and watch you spiraling down to the car park. The only instance of violence about this is me destroying you and your paper. Well, thanks very much for coming on, and we'll see you after the global Holocaust, which has been started by and some errant geoengineering and resulted in the fiery nuclear death of everybody on Earth. But you can come and gloat as we meet each other in the post-apocalyptic wasteland that follows your predictions coming right. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.